How have the people of North Korea been impacted by the Korean War, and how did that war shape their perceptions of the United States? Is the Trump administration's standoff with North Korea unprecedented or a continuation of previous administration policies? What connection is there between the recent detonation of a MOAB bomb in Afghanistan and the Korean situation? Could Trump be invoking a Nixon-era ploy in his bombast and bluster toward North Korea and her Chinese ally? What would be the preconditions for an anti-war movement that could effectively challenge a ruling order set on war? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a detailed look at the Trump administration's military buildup around North Korea and gauge the possibility that this standoff could lead to an unthinkable nuclear conflagration. Our guest for the entire hour is Global Research founder and director, Professor Michelle Chosadovsky. On this week's program, Cuban Missile Crisis in Slow Motion, Michelle Chosadovsky on North Korea and the looming nuclear danger. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 5th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. This extreme danger is the new global reality. If the elimination of the threat does not come from the U.S. White House, the culmination of the threat will, regardless of which side strikes first. The decision either to invade Russia or else to cancel and condemn America's decade-plus preparation to do so can be made only by the U.S. president. If he remains silent about the matter, then Putin can reasonably proceed on the assumption that he'll have to be the one to strike first. He didn't place himself in that position. The U.S. regime did. That comes from the article, America's top scientists confirm U.S. goal now is to conquer Russia, disarming enemies with a surprise nuclear first strike. By Eric Zeus, posted May 4th. THAAD in South Korea is directed against China's retaliatory forces. It is part of Washington's preparations to nuke both Russia and China with minimal consequence to the U.S., although Europe would certainly be completely destroyed, as THAAD or anti-ABMs are useless against Russian nuclear cruise missiles and the Russian Air Force. But no empire has ever cared about the fate of its vassals, and Washington is uninterested in Europe's fate. Washington is interested only in its hegemony over the world. The question is, now that Russia and China understand that Washington is preparing for a preemptive nuclear strike against them in order to remove the two constraints on Washington's unilateral behavior, will the two countries sit there and wait for the strike? That comes from the article, What the North Korean Crisis is Really About, Pretext to Nuke Both Russia and China? By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted May 4th. Education is designed to kill individual thinking and the wide range of inventiveness because it's dangerous for those who enslave and control us. Newspeak education has to make us thinking what the system wants us to think. That's what Western education has become in the last 50 years, a farce to keep us as non-thinking idiots. Idiots are easily enslaved and exploited and sent to wars to steal foreign resources to satisfy the greed of a few. We love to be cannon fodder, as we were told, enslaved, to believe that good patriots love to die for their country. We are blinded and avoid seeing that we are dying fighting to satisfy puppet leaders' greed from power and money, whose power is nothing more than that allowed them by the masters who control the world and who pull the strings on their marionettes. That comes from the article, Slavehood 2017, Social Chaos and Global Warfare, Puppet Leaders' Greed for Power and Money, by Peter Koenig, posted May 4th. General Scaparotti made the wild claim that Russia is the enemy of Europe, Ukraine, Georgia, and perhaps most astonishingly of all, an enemy of Turkey. In reality, Turkey is pivoting away from NATO and the EU, and in terms of trade and diplomatic cooperation, is looking increasingly to Russia as a partner. This is happening in spite of the totally divergent goals between Ankara and Moscow in Turkey. Nevertheless, Turkey is one of the key participants in the Astana peace talks, while the U.S. has no official role. Furthermore, the chief advisor to Turkish President Erdogan has said that Turkey may, quote-unquote, accidentally fire upon U.S. troops in Syria during Turkey's protracted war with Kurdish forces. That comes from the article, Dangerous Crossroads, U.S. General Says NATO Is Ready to Fight Russia in Europe, by Adam Gari, posted May 4th, originally appearing at The Duran. David Krieger, president of the Santa Barbara-based Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, noted, "How does one test the effectiveness of a weapons system that is designed as a deterrent, that is, to prevent others from ever using nuclear weapons against us? Such effectiveness cannot be assumed from a missile test, no matter how ready we are to fire the missile or how accurate the missile proves to be. In other words, so-called effectiveness, quote-unquote, is a psychological concept that cannot be proven by a missile test. This is a very dangerous game we are playing," unquote. That comes from the article, U.S. to launch another provocative Minuteman III ICBM test amidst accusations directed against North Korea, by Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, posted May 3rd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Michelle Chosudovsky is founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. He is professor emeritus of economics at the University of Ottawa and the award-winning author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, America's War on Terrorism, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. He's also written articles recently dealing specifically with the Korean crisis and the looming dangers of a nuclear war. He joined us by phone.
What was the Korean War really all about? Was it a fight for freedom as it's portrayed in the popular media, or was there some other agenda at stake there?
Well, the war against the people of Korea, 1953, was essentially a colonial war waged by the United States. It was a war of conquest, or at least attempted conquest. And it was a genocide. And we don't need to necessarily debate the figures on the casualties of that war inflicted by the United States, because General Curtis LeMay, who coordinated the bombing raids against North Korea, brazenly acknowledged, and I quote, "Over a period of 3 years or so, we killed off, 20% of the population. We burned down every town in North Korea and South Korea, too." And historians now acknowledge that the population of North Korea, which was of the order of 8 to 9 million, and that during the 37-month-long hot war from 50 to 53, the Korean nation had a mortality which was something of the order of 30% of its population, which is unprecedented in world history, or at least if you compare those figures to casualties of major countries involved in World War II. In other words, we have to reflect a country which has lost one quarter, at least one quarter of its population in a U.S.-led war. What is their perception of national security? Who is a threat to their national security? It's obviously the United States of America. Not a single family in North Korea has not lost a loved one during that war. And people in America don't know. Imagine what would happen if a quarter of the population of the United States of America were liquidated by some foreign country. That is what happened in North Korea. And that is, and then we have to also understand that the Korean War, there was never a peace treaty. The North has requested the signing of a peace treaty. There was an armistice agreement. And since 1953, there have been persistent threats with nuclear weapons. In fact, the threat of nuclear attack against North Korea started in 1950. And it wasn't carried out because then the Soviet Union had also acquired nuclear capabilities. But bear in mind, we're talking about a period from 1950 to 2017, in other words, 67 years of threats using nuclear weapons against a small country, some 20 million people today. And if you look at pictures of what Pyongyang looked like in the wake of that war, it was totally destroyed, more than 90%. It was just every single building. And bear in mind, that's confirmed by the U.S. military. They don't deny it. In other words, they liquidated, and it was directed against civilians. Okay? They destroyed everything. Now they have rebuilt. And Pyongyang is a city with skyscrapers. It's a modern city. It's interesting to look at what it was when it was simply destroyed and look at it today. So how is it that this country, which lost a quarter or more of its population during the Korean War, could be considered a threat to the security of the United States of America, which happens to be thousands of miles away, whereas in turn the United States of America has more than 30,000 troops stationed in Korea, in South Korea, and that is the only U.S. military facility on the Asian continent. There are other, of course, bases in Okinawa and elsewhere, but on the Asian continent, it is the sole U.S. military facility. I'm talking about, there's also Afghanistan, and I'm talking about essentially East Asia. But that has to be taken into account.
I know that the Korean Peninsula borders on both Russia and China. So is that essentially, you talk about it being a colonial war, was it essentially with an eye to getting U.S. bases right next door to those two giants?
Well, it was essentially to take over the territories of the Japanese Empire. And also to threaten China and Russia, but bear in mind that the United States essentially wanted to establish a sphere of influence in East Asia, which they have. They have troops stationed in South Korea, since the end of World War II. They interfere in Korean politics. I'm talking about South Korea, in the same way as they interfere in other parts of the world. And then we must understand that, first of all, there are two things which are very important. If there is a nuclear attack against North Korea, that nuclear attack is, in fact, also against the entire Korean nation, both north and south. And that has to do with, it has to do with geography, and people have to understand geography. The distance between the center of Seoul and the demilitarized zone, in other words, the border with North Korea, is 57 kilometers. Now, that's pretty much the distance between Manhattan and New Jersey or Montreal, and Toronto and Mississauga. I live 50 kilometers from Montreal. So in other words, the distances are such that any kind of attack against North Korea using nuclear weapons will radiate over the entire nation. And of course, it would have global implications because it could ignite a Third World War. But the other issue which we must understand is that the THAAD missiles are not intended for North Korea. They're intended for Russia and China, and specifically China. And I should mention there's a very strategic island which is located south of the Korean Peninsula. It's Jeju Island. It was the naval base of the Japanese forces during World War II. It has now become both a naval as well as an Air Force facility, with major partners being the United States, Japan, and South Korea. And Jeju Island is almost within... It's directly opposite Shanghai, okay? It's directly opposite Shanghai. You could practically swim it. It's within a few hundred kilometers of Shanghai, and it's very strategically located. So that, in effect, there's another process which is ongoing, is the militarization of all the waterways surrounding China, from the
South China Sea.
Yeah, from the East China Sea, and the Sea of Japan, the East China Sea, down to the South China Sea. All these strategic waterways are militarized, and China, in a sense, is surrounded by military facilities. Its sovereignty is threatened. And then there's also, we know that there are also U.S. military facilities located on China's western frontier. In other words, in Pakistan, Afghanistan in particular. So that there you have to look at the broader geopolitics. The Korean Peninsula is very, very important. And there's another aspect is... in South Korea, as well as in the North, there's a strong movement for reunification. And this has been a big debate in both North and South for years on. But the United States doesn't want that reunification. And if it wants that reunification, it wants it
on their terms.
Conditions, which, and I quote some military documents, they say that if Korea is to reunify, then we would station troops in North Korea. That is the scenario which is contemplated.
I wonder what extent that reunification movement is directed, because I know there have been protests lately in South Korea, but they're protesting the THAAD missile system, and they seem to be protesting U.S. involvement as opposed to... so it's not in coinciding with what the rest of us are hearing about the belligerence and dangerousness of the North Korean government. So to what extent is this pro-unification versus anti-U.S. involvement?
Well, the thing is, there's a very strong movement, grassroots movement in South Korea against the stationing of U.S. troops. And that's been ongoing. In other words, they want those troops out, okay? They're a sovereign country. They want them out. They're not a sovereign country. And in fact, the entire military of South Korea is under the command of the U.S. They have a military cooperation agreement. And in the case of war, it's not the commander-in-chief, which is the president of the Republic of Korea, which calls the shots. It's a three-star general appointed by the Pentagon, and that's very, very clear. So that they want sovereignty, they want political sovereignty, namely the choice of their head of state, and they want sovereignty from the point of view of military affairs, and the Korean people want the unification of the two Koreas. I say the Republic of Korea, and they don't see necessarily. These are not separate issues. The THAAD missiles, the presence of U.S. troops, the war games, all of that is combined. And I think the other aspect to all this is that Korea is a very powerful industrial nation in the world economy. I'm talking about South Korea. But if South Korea and North Korea were to reunite, you'd have an even more powerful nation, which not only has industrial capabilities in high tech and so on and so forth, but also in the weapons industry, which North Korea has. But I think what is very important, people have to realize that yes, a quarter of the population of that country was killed by carpet bombing. Who is the threat to global security? North Korea or the United States of America? And I think that the answer to that question is pretty obvious in view of what's happening both in Asia as well as in other parts of the world. What's happening in Syria, what's happening in Iraq, what's happening in Afghanistan. And it's a killing machine. And it is essentially a killing machine directed against civilians.
I know that back in after 9/11, there was that announcement of the Axis of Evil by the Bush administration, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. So I know that it's gotten pretty prominent billing as one of those threats that they were determined to address. I'm wondering just how unprecedented what the current maneuvers that we're seeing are, given that 67-year history that you referred to earlier. I mean, have we come this close to a nuclear or other conflict with North Korea before? Or have there been close calls that are worthy?
No, there have been several. This is not unprecedented. It's maybe different because you have a different rhetoric, and you've got Donald Trump, who is a very unpredictable individual, has absolutely no understanding of geopolitics, and who could press the button during a dinner event I'm recalling the dinner event with the Chinese head of state. But I mean, you have a situation. I think that the very dangerous danger is that the decision makers, those who push the button in the case of a nuclear war, they believe in their own propaganda, and they believe that nuclear weapons are harmless to the surrounding civilian population because the explosion is underground, quote unquote. That is with regard to the tactical nuclear weapons. And they think that they can actually wage a nuclear war and come out clean without blowing up the planet. No, that won't occur. But they believe in it, and they don't have the foggiest idea of the causes and consequences of nuclear war, which are amply documented by a large body of scientists and analysts. I've looked into U.S. Nuclear doctrine starting in the immediately after the 9/11 attacks, and in 2002, what does the Senate do? They reclassify the tactical nuclear weapons which have an explosive capacity between one-third and 12 times the Hiroshima bomb as conventional weapons, which can be used in the conventional war theater and do not even require the authorization of the commander-in-chief. Very people know about that. There was another thing that was in 2003 when the Pentagon called a meeting at Strategic Command Headquarters in Nebraska. That's where they filmed Dr. Strangelove. And they invited the defense contractors, the analysts, the research labs to a meeting. And it was held between the 6th and the 9th of August 2003, which happened to coincide with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And they were not commemorating. They were planning the major outlays in nuclear weapons, which are now occurring, the trillion dollar budget allocated to a new generation of nuclear bombs. They don't need any more nuclear bombs. They've got 7,000 nuclear bombs. Why would they need to have another generation of bombs? But I think that what they want to have is a first strike, which would annihilate the capabilities of any kind of response on the part of a rogue enemy, so to speak. But talking about scenarios, now I've been looking at World War III scenarios for some time. My book on Towards a World War III Scenario was published in 2011. It hasn't, people get scared with this kind of title. But when we talk about scenarios of World War III, they do them every year. They have them. They're not active war games, and some of them are public. You mentioned the rogue states. Well, the rogue states are defined. There are four rogue states which are defined in U.S. military doctrine, and they are Iran, Russia, China, North Korea. And now in the year 2007, under what was called Vigilant Shield War Games, they were simulating a war with four fictitious countries, which were called Ermingham, Rubek, Churia, and Nemesi. Now, Ermingham is Iran, Rubek is Russia, Churia is China, and Nemesi is North Korea. And this is a very detailed scenario of I included it in my book, and it starts with the road to conflict. It's a simulation of a whole sequence of events which ultimately leads to World War III. And to say that they're not into envisaging and analyzing World War III, they are. What they don't envisage are the consequences of their actions, because they believe that World War III is a peacemaking undertaking. Mm. And so we have a combination of diabolical, idiosyncratic decision-making, which could lead the planet to the unthinkable, where top officials believe their propaganda. So it's not simply a question of convincing the public. That's one area of propaganda. There's propaganda, there's an internal propaganda, which is directed against whom? Against it's in favor of whom? It's politicians within the U.S. Congress, the Senate, it's the people, the academics, it's people in the military and intelligence, it's people, of course, in the areas of business, the military-industrial complex, Wall Street. All these people, if you ask them, what do you think will happen if we use nuclear weapons? They don't know.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Can I just get you to comment on April 13th, according to the Pentagon, the MOAB, the mother of all bombs, or massive ordnance air blast bomb, as it's called, as was dropped over an area in Nangarhar province in Afghanistan, you're bordering onto Pakistan. Supposedly, it's where ISIS forces were suspected of holding tunnels and buildings. So when you see an incident like that happening at this time, what does that mean? What's the point? Is it really as they say, or is there another message that's being communicated? Where do you position that event in this broader context that we're looking at?
Well, that event, I think, first of all, is twofold. First, it is a test of the bomb, a live test of that bomb. We're not sure whether it actually occurred previously. It might have occurred in Iraq, but they tested that bomb in a remote area of Afghanistan, bordering onto Pakistan, and it was framed in a way to saying we're going after ISIS. Of course, that is first of all a non sequitur, because ISIS is a creation of U.S. intelligence, well known and documented, that the ISIS is not an independent force in its own right. It's a wing of Al-Qaeda, and it's supported covertly, and it's supported and financed by America's allies, including Saudi Arabia. And then, of course, they go after it to give us the impression that there's a counterterrorism agenda. There is no real counterterrorism agenda, because the Al-Qaeda terrorist group and its various affiliates are supported by those who are waging the counterterrorism agenda. Now, that explosion took place. There are reports. We don't know anything about what actually happened. There's no photographic evidence, there were statements from the Afghan government, and then there were statements from the Pentagon. They said that when 96 people were killed, and all of them without exception are ISIS operatives, it took place in a mountainous area. We haven't seen any pictures of what this bomb has done. It's an earth penetrating bomb. And at the same time, it will release a mushroom cloud, which is similar to that of a nuclear bomb. It's the largest conventional, it's an enormous heavy bomb. You can't send it in. You have to drop it, and that's what they did. But I think that it is also there to serve a propaganda. As an instrument of propaganda to show, well, this is the kind of bomb that we could maybe drop on North Korea.
There is a tendency to portray this, the Trump presidency, as somehow in idiosyncratic and whatnot. But I wanted to evoke and maybe get your thoughts on this. Back at the time of the Nixon administration, they practiced what he himself called the madman theory. And this was something documented by I guess it was one of his head of state at the time. And what he said was that, I want the North Vietnamese to believe I've reached the point where I might do anything to stop the war. We'll just slip the word to them that, for God's sake, you know, Nixon is obsessed about communism. We can't restrain him when he's angry, and he has his hand on the nuclear button. And Ho Chi Minh himself will be in Paris in 2 days begging for peace. This idea that, like, he's so, you know, someone who's the most, you know, armed, the head of the most armed country in the world is kind of crazy. So, you know, do you think maybe Trump might be trying to deliberately, or maybe his advisors are trying to portray him in this way, to employ that kind of madman strategy toward North Korea, I guess by extension China and Russia, and could such a strategy, if true, could it succeed?
Well, I think we have to address the decision-making processes behind the use of these weapons of mass destruction. And it's not the head of state, it's not the president of the United States which actually will make that decision on his own in any way. Although, of course, from a legal point of view, he has the last word. He could block it or he can say yes. It's an army of advisors and consultants and ideologues with think tanks, the military. But ultimately, it's not the military that calls the shots either. It's really civilians who will determine whether we use it or not. But here I think that Trump is probably more idiosyncratic than Richard Nixon. But I don't think that ultimately, I think it's his entourage. It's the people who are in his cabinet, which are dangerous, so to speak, particularly Mad Dog Mattis, Tillerson, maybe to a lesser extent. But they reflect, in a sense, the continuity of U.S. foreign policy going back to to the Truman Doctrine in the late 40s, and what was formulated by George Kennan at the time, as a sort of an imperial agenda, this idea of killing millions of civilians is ingrained. Of course, you never mention it officially, but if you look at history. At the loss of life attributable to U.S.-led wars, and we're talking about Korea, one quarter of the population killed in North Korea. We're talking about Vietnam. We're talking about Indonesia, where the CIA ordered more or less up to 1 million communist partisans and their families to be executed. That again, it's a massive casualty event. It's not through an act of warfare, but it's the kind of thing which the United States does. And then you look at other wars around the world, which are very often considered to be civil wars, like those in Sudan or in the Congo. But in fact, we're talking about millions and millions of people who lost their lives. The war in Sudan is barely mentioned. Several million people lost their lives through various mechanisms, as well as mass, as well as starvation. So that is the agenda. Mm-hmm. And then they have to convince. Ultimately, they have to convince the broader public that killing the dudes, the bad guys, is a peacemaking operation. But there's so many millions of bad guys who are targeted. And now you have this wave of Islamophobia, which is directed against, a large, we're talking about what, the Muslim population in the world, are more than a billion population. It just so happens that more than 60% of the reserves of crude oil happen to lie in Muslim countries. Mm. And what you demonize the inhabitants of those countries. If they had been occupied by Buddhists, then the Buddhists. It would have been another campaign. But people don't realize that. Why are we going after the Muslims? Mm. Why are they the bad guys? Well, it just so happened to own the oil, okay?
Yeah.
It is something of the order of 69% of the crude oil. I'm not talking about tar sands and so on and natural gas. But crude oil, they control within their territories. They have the oil. So why do you go after them?
Could you talk about talking about going after? I mean, just maybe shifting way across to the other side of the world, because I feel the need to bring up Latin America with you, particularly Venezuela, where we seem to be seeing an increase in tensions, the opposition to Nicolás Maduro. It's not as obvious as, you know, people with guns and MOAB bombs. That you're seeing a kind of a mobilization, a weaponization of a popular sentiment. And I wonder if you could comment briefly about some of what you see happening in Venezuela, and then maybe if there's any historical analogs that you might be familiar with.
Well, the historical analog is the fact that Venezuela was an oil colony of the Texas oil companies, going back to a dictator which they installed, Juan Vicente Gomez, who was a Calvillo. He was a U.S. sponsored dictator, as in many other countries of the continent. Okay, and then it was Perez Jimenez, also a dictatorship, and then ultimately there was a movement to democratic government, which in large part was controlled by the United States up to a point. And when Chavez emerged, they established a policy of sovereignty over their oil reserves. And I don't want to get into the complexities of what happened. But ultimately, I think what is at stake is the fact that this country asserted in one form or another its sovereignty over its resources, over its territory. And now, of course, that process is in the process of being reversed with a regime change agenda directed against the Maduro presidency.
Mm-hmm. And so such a regime change operation, the consequences are not just for Venezuela, but throughout the entire continent, if I'm not mistaken. The fate of the Bolivarian revolution is going to be affected by whatever happens in Venezuela with the...
Well, that has, in fact, that has already happened. You have a number of so-called progressive governments in the continent. Some of them, we're talking about essentially Ecuador, Bolivia, Venezuela, Cuba. You could say that these governments have taken on a certain position against U.S. imperialism, although at the same time they've been obliged to compromise in a number of areas. Brazil and Argentina, which had progressive governments, were up to a point. That has been reversed to a large extent through regime change. I think to get back to the broader issue, we have to look at what some people call non-conventional warfare, or hybrid warfare. In other words, or maybe I'm not using the term in the right way, but regime change is intimately related to the broader military and economic agenda. So in some countries you go in with your armed forces, in other countries you trigger a regime change, in other countries you send in special forces and you don't necessarily invade. I mean, there's so many mechanisms to subvert and destroy countries, and the objective is not necessarily... the objective is ultimately to transform countries into open territories for the free market. So it ties into neoliberalism. In Syria, the objective is not necessarily... Syria and Iraq, the objective is not necessarily to win a war. The objective is ultimately to ensure that that country will not be able to rebuild in a sovereign way. And that's what happened to Vietnam. The United States withdrew from Vietnam. The Vietnamese said, we won the war, but what is Vietnam today? It's a cheap labor colony of Western capitalism, Western and Japanese. I mean, everything has been ultimately destroyed. It applies neoliberalism. It's under the guidance of the International Monetary Fund. The wages are amongst the lowest in the world, you know, $100 a month. It's a haven for relocation of industry. So that everything they fought for has been lost. And I should mention there's another very important transition that took place in Vietnam, is that it was really the defeat of French colonialism and the replacement of French colonialism by the new order of American imperialism. And that's happening in different parts of the world. That's why France is also becoming, in a sense, a dependent nation, losing its own sovereignty. It doesn't have any more colonies. Mm-hmm. And if you want to be significant in the capitalist global order, you have to have colonies. You have to have dependent states, and they don't. Mm-hmm. And they are themselves becoming a dependent state.
Recapping a little bit of what you've been saying over the last conversation, that you, first of all, with Trump, it's not just Trump. There's this whole the elements behind him. So much of the bureaucracy of the civilian bureaucracy has been infected with this with these neocons, the cons that have festered to the point where this is affecting the decision making apparatus, and you've got a whole bunch of people in there who, it's not just that they're lying in order to secure these colonies and the dominance of the petrodollar and maintaining areas for bases and whatnot. They actually seem to believe these things, and so that. It ends up enabling the desires of the bankers. But I guess there's a point where you might potentially have created a Frankenstein's monster that could destroy everything.
Well, the thing is, I think what's very dangerous there is that the lie has become the truth. And the lie has become a consensus. In other words, a whole series of lies, but let's say that the lie is a composite there. I mean, if we can establish certain truthful statements and we can corroborate them, but then now the lie has replaced the truth, and you no longer necessarily need to discuss or debate whether the lie is truthful or not. People believe that Russia intervenes in elections. People believe that nuclear weapons are harmless to civilians. People believe that genetically modified seeds and so on is good for health, and so on and so forth. And they're led to believe things which can be easily refuted, that anybody with a common sense can refute. Or that the bad guys are there in Guantanamo and so on and so forth. And torture is good because it's going to help make the world safer. And extrajudicial killings are also good because we'll go after the bad dudes and so on and so forth. It's a whole composite. But what I'm saying is that when the lie becomes the truth, society, there's no moving backwards. We are, in a sense, we're precipitated into what I would describe as an inquisitorial environment. In other words, the Spanish and French Inquisitions of the Middle Age were based on the notion that you don't question the established authority. Okay? They say, well, these people are witches. We accept that. And today they'll say, well, these people are conspiracy theorists. We accept that. In other words, and then if Donald Trump or his military advisors say nuclear weapons is good for your health, people will accept it. And in fact, I can tell you that that is exactly what is contained in the military manuals when they describe the tactical nuclear weapon. They're changing the label of the nuclear weapons. And so we're being told a whole pack of lies, and people are incited to accept those lies as indelible truths. Okay, so that there's been it's an Orwellian environment, but it's gone even much further than Orwellian environment. Mm-hmm. And that is what I'd call the American Inquisition. It's not even a question of saying, provide the truth that this is not a lie or that this is truthful. You don't need to hide the fact that people are being tortured because they're doing it. They're actually showing us in Guantanamo how people are being treated, okay? We don't need to start investigating. And then eventually people say, well, this is a new normal. Guantanamo is acceptable because these people in Guantanamo are the bad guys. And so on.
Okay. Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left. I don't know if there's anything that you could say in terms of providing some escape valve from this buildup, because it seems that I know Global Research has been around since 2001. Have you seen any signs that the kind of truth-telling that yours and other independent websites are putting out this information and undermining the legitimacy of these powers that be? Are you seeing any signs of hope that we can escape this death spiral?
Well, what I think we can say, and that's not being very optimistic, is that the anti-war movement is dead. There is no anti-war movement. And in large part, it's because progressive elements within the anti-war movement consider that the wars in Syria or in Libya are humanitarian wars. And that includes even Noam Chomsky, who has literally given his support to U.S. Actions in Syria, saying that Assad is committing monstrous atrocities, I'm quote. And so that there's a certain complicity of the progressive left, particularly in the United States, but also we can see it in Western Europe, we can see it in France. Okay? And so that, in effect, what we have to start doing is to rebuild the anti-war movement. And we have to rebuild it outside the realm of tax-free foundations which fund the social summits and all that. It has to be an extensive grassroots movement. It mustn't be partisan. It has to integrate people from all walks of life, workplaces, schools, universities, parishes, and so on. But that in itself is not going to change the decision-making processes unless at the same time we have a movement within the armed forces, within intelligence, within the realms of decision-making in civilian government. In other words, history tells us that if you really want meaningful change, you have to have internal change within the internal decision-making apparatus. It's not by simply going out in the streets and chanting, stop the war in Syria and no to nuclear war in North Korea, that things will change. They don't. That's what I call anti-war sentiment. What you have to do is to start creating an environment where there is confrontation of ideas and so on within the armed forces. Also, refuse to fight. In other words...
And support those who refuse to fight.
Of course, because those who are fighting those wars are told that they are indoctrinated into believing that they're actually fighting Al-Qaeda, okay, that they're going after the bad guys, after terrorists. They're not. Some of them, of course, when they come back, they speak out. But That is a very important movement. It's not sufficient to simply say, you know, let's go out and do what we did before the war in Iraq, when millions of people went to the streets. But it didn't prevent the war from occurring. And that's because Trump wanted to do, which was his blitzkrieg. Mm-hmm. And so we need to have people within the realm of government at all levels, you know, not the central government, the municipal governments, the state governments, etc. And it has to be global, it has to be worldwide. Now that's not an easy proposition, certainly yeah. not an easy proposition, but it has to be. We have to understand where we're going, and people have to organize. And it's not the left that is going to do it. I'm saying not the left. The so-called co-opted left, yeah. which is going to do it, because they're paying lip service to these wars. They okay. have systematically. They paid lip service to the invasion of Afghanistan. They paid lip service to the invasion of Libya, mm-hmm. and we can check it out. So that we have to rebuild social movements. We have to also understand the relationship between war and the neoliberal agenda. They're not two separate processes.
And, okay.
When I was involved with going to world summits or counter summits, I noticed that the issue of war was never actually mentioned. Neoliberalism was on the table, but they never looked at the geopolitical or strategic or military dimensions of neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. And so we were looking at things very separately. And the fact of the matter is that all those counter summits are funded precisely by the people who are funding the wars.
We're talking about the manufacture of dissent. I think that's your phrase for it.
Well, that is the issue. It's the manufactured dissent. It's the fact that dissent is yep. funded by the Rockefellers and so on, and the same financial interests which support the official agenda, whether it's the neoliberal agenda as well as the so-called defense agenda, are the people who will be funding dissent in some form or another, but also at the same time with a view to actually. Mm-hmm. Maintaining dissent within a certain realm of debate.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess that there's a saying that the revolution will not be televised, and unfortunately the fake revolutions are being televised. So, Professor Choskovsky, it's really been a pleasure speaking with you. I know you've got a lot of things to work on today, but I think that our listeners appreciate your insights as always, and hopefully we can have you back again to share more of your thoughts.
Well, thank you very much. We do need the support of our listeners and our readers at globalresearch.ca, as well as our French language website, mondialisation.ca, and we've now started up with a Spanish website, which is globalisation.ca, which is located in Mexico City. But we are up against this whole tide of smearing the independent media, and more than ever, we need our readers to get the word out in social media and across the land that these issues are debated. And and again, the Global Research News Hour is playing a very important role in that regard. Thank you very much, Michael, for this invitation.
That conversation with Michel Chossudovsky was recorded on May 2nd, 2017. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.